try not to crack any of the pillow. Are ready to start? So good morning and welcome to the morning meeting of the students in McGill's Investment Management program here in the Diz Hotel Faculty of Management. Whilst we study in the Investment Management program, we are also working for Diz Hotel Capital Management, Inc., which is a registered investment management firm, and which is the manager of the Diz Hotel Global Equity Fund and the Diz Hotel Fixed Income Fund. This morning, you will hear some investment ideas and investment research from students in the first year of the program. You will be able to ask questions after the presentations. There will also be coffee and pastries afterwards if you have a few minutes at the end to meet with them. Thank you. I am John Taraf, MBA candidate and analyst at Diz Hotel Capital Management, Inc. I will be talking to you about the Laurentian Bank of Canada, ticker LB on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Let's give you a quick overview. It's a Quebec regional bank, for those of you who are not familiar with it, about 3,600 employees. It operates about 156 branches and 410 ATMs here in Quebec. It is the third largest retail branch network in the province. Recently, about 70 ATMs were added to the their network, and they are located in the subway system of Montreal after winning a contract, an exclusive contract from the Société de Transport de Montréal. The lines of business, if you want to look at them from the perspective of their contribution to net income, the retail banking side, which is personal financial services and small and medium enterprises services, it's about 40%, followed by trust services and commercial real estate financing, more or less same contribution to net income, about 26-27% each. And finally, the capital markets division, which contributes only about 7%. By far, it's the smallest division of the bank. The institutional ownership is about 24%. Market cap, as of the close of yesterday, is about $1.05 billion. Looking forward, the management strategy is to diversify revenue sources, specifically increasing the wealth management contribution within the capital markets division. Looking at the stock performance over the past 3 years, we can see that currently it's trading more or less at the levels of 2008, which are the all-time high for the bank. It closed at about 43.50 yesterday. 2009 highlights, revenues came in at about $1.2 billion. They were pretty much flat over 2008. The loss provisions, that is the credit loss provisions, of course, regarding loans, was higher than 2008, came in at $56 million. However, there were signs that it was stabilizing because the past three quarters, it remained at the same level of $16 million per quarter. The net income is $102 million, increase over 2008. As a matter of fact, for Laurentian Bank is the only bank in Canada that was able to post higher earnings per share for the past 5 years consecutively. The return on income in 2009 came in at 11%, slightly below what it came in 2008, 11.5. The dividend was increased in 2009. This is a mistake here. It should have been 8 cents and not 10 cents, so please take that note. I apologize. 8 cents increased to 1.44 annually. Salaries expenses were up in 2009, surprisingly. They actually hired people, mostly in their mortgage sales force. The key measures looking at 2010, just to give you an idea where we're standing, most recently, 12% ROE. Tier 1 capital improved, went up to 11%, was in the range of 9% in 2008. Assets to capital leverage is about 18.5 times, so pretty much in line with all the other banks in Canada. Loans to deposit decreased a bit. It's about 88% now. Long-term debt to market cap, solid at 14%. The book value per share, most recent book value per share, is close to $40. The payout ratio is 30%. It's not a, although they increased the dividend, it's still very acceptable, the level of the payout ratio, so we can still expect to see some growth. Effective tax rate is 27%. Let's look a little bit about at the earnings in the first quarter of 2010. So the net income came at $32 million. We're going to try to compare it to the previous quarter and not to the first quarter of 2009, simply because I think it is a better benchmark, to a more recent benchmark, and as you all know, first quarter of 2009 was quite particular. So I think the previous one is a better representative of the bank's underlying business and its performance. So net income did improve by about $2.5 million, mostly due to lower to higher volume growth in the mortgage and the personal loan sector, and lower interest expense. So on both sides, they were able to increase their revenues and they were able to control their costs. Yes, net interest margin was slightly lower at 2.13 and 2.8. It's not a significant decrease, but the increase in volume was enough to offset the lower margin. The non-interest revenue came in flat. However, the related expenses were lower by about $8 million, and this improved the efficiency ratio quite significantly. It improved to 66.7. Whereas it was about 71%, if I'm not mistaken, in the previous quarter. Looking forward, we projected the earnings for the bank in a quite conservative way. I left it flat growth in interest income, and same for the non-interest income for the next two quarters going forward, so Q2 and Q3 2010. Even the loan loss provision, although we believe that they pretty much peaked at $16 million. I kept it at that level for the next three quarters, for Q2, Q3, and Q4, simply to account for, you know, for to be conservative and to account for the worst case scenario. The net income comes in at about flat in the next quarter, 1.2 per quarter, pretty much at the same level. Ending the year at about 4.78, and as for next year, we're looking at an EPS of about 5.1. The growth that I included in Q4 and 2011 reflect as well the possibility of an interest rate hike. The valuation, looking at it, the price that I used here as current price was the March 17 closing. It was at 44.32. As I said yesterday, it closed at lower than that. It closed at the 43.50 or 0.60 range. Just to give you an idea at where it traded before and the relative valuation of the stock, the average, the 10-year average P/E ratio is about 11.5 for Laurentian, and it's about 1.1 for its book value, its P/E ratio. You would see that some analysts might have slightly different averages, and that's really depending on whether they took out the outliers, the highest and the lowest P/E over the past 10 years. The sector average in comparison is higher than that. Laurentian Bank traditionally has traded at a discount to its peers. Obviously, it's a smaller bank. It commands a lower premium, and it's regional. It's located in Quebec. Especially with regards to book value, as you can see, the peers trade at about 1.7 on average. That's quite a difference. The closest comparables that I was able to pull out and look into were the Canadian Western Bank and National Bank of Canada, which is here in Quebec as well, and some parts of Ontario, some exposure to the U.S. as well. So they're not exactly an excellent comparable, but they're the closest we can get. And you can see as well, Laurentian Bank is trading at a discount to these. My recommendation for the stock is a buy, and my target for 2010, for October 31st, is $50. I was able to reach this target by applying a P/E ratio that is that is very close to its historical average, but yet at a discount. It's at 11 compared to its comparable to its average of 11.5. The EPS, as I previously said, I project them at 4.78 at the end of 2008. So we get to an upper range figure of about $53. The price to book ratio, on the other hand, I applied the current PB, which is the average PB, 1.1, to our $43 book value per share projected for the end of 2010. We arrived at the lower range of 47, so we're looking at a mid figure of about $50. The analyst consensus out there, just for the sake of comparison, is about $50 as well. There's seven analysts covering the stock, including names like Macquarie and RBC Capital Markets. The EPS projection is slightly lower than mine, at 4.55. Mind you that they haven't, some of them haven't updated their research and their reports after the Q1 earnings came out not a long time ago. So the investment rationale behind it, just to sum up, it's mostly from a valuation point of view. Given the forecast, as we can see, it's quite attractive. There's room for growth and price appreciation. We've seen healthy growth trends in the core retail business, especially, you know, when you're able to grow your mortgages and your loans in a period of credit crunches where others aren't able to do so. This shows really the command of Laurentian Bank of its market and the well-defended niche in Quebec. Its potential for significant growth in the wealth management business specifically. The improvement in efficiency was significant as well, so that's always a good sign when you can control your costs and get a bigger bang for your dollar. Stabilization of loan losses, again, this is an excellent sign. For the past three quarters, as I said, it was stabilized at $60 million. And looking forward, I would expect it to start falling, although in my earnings I kept them at the same level for the next three quarters. Finally, the stable dividend. They actually increased the dividend last year, as I previously said. And right now, the current yield is about 3.25. It's pretty decent. The potential risks, on the other hand, to my recommendation, obviously opportunities opportunities comes with threats. Stricter banking regulation requiring higher capital levels and imposing lower leverage limits might be one of the risks to the ability of the bank to produce higher earnings. It also might create some dilution if they had to raise capital in the form of equity. The dilution effect, I took it into consideration in my earnings projection again, starting in Q3 and Q4 of this year. So I diluted the shares by about 5% just to account for a possible attempt to raise capital. Legislation, again, a big chunk of their business, actually the majority of their business, comes from personal financial services, and a big chunk of that are card products. So we're talking credit cards and debit cards and interest rates and fees that could be charged on these products. Any legislation limiting these fees might hinder their earnings as well. The proposed or the talks about proposing legislation that would require clients to basically come up with larger down payments and higher equity requirements in order to get to get their residential mortgage from the banks, that could be another limitation to the volume growth in that segment that they're very strong in. Any reacceleration in credit losses could be, again, a threat. And a sluggish economy, of course, in Quebec, housing bubble in Canada or in Quebec specifically, would pose a major risk to the bank and its earnings. Finally, any systematic correction in financial markets. The bank's beta is about 1. It moves pretty much with the market, so systematic correction in it would definitely hurt the price of the stock. That pretty much concludes my presentation. If you have any other questions, I'll be glad to take them. Thank you. If you have any question, you can always email me. Thank you.
my name is Mathieu Boulian. I'm the junior equity analyst for telecommunications and IT, and I'll present to you Research in Motion today. So you all know Research in Motion, developed by BlackBerry, introduced in 1999. All right, so on Wednesday's closing, it was trading at 74.49. So, I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Its 52-week range is between 38.27 and 88. Currently, the consensus target price is 86.29, trading at a PE of 18.56. Its two-year PE range between 10.71 and 62.82, with a bid of 1.3. No dividend yield, market cap of 41.5 billion. Insider owns 11.44%, while institutional 62.14%. This is just a graph showing you for the past year and a half how it traded. Of course, still not at the level of 2008 before the crisis. Now, my investment rationale, why invest in RIM now? First, in most corporate IT departments right now, the average enterprise device now age is 2 years, and they'll be aggressively buying BlackBerries to refresh the cycle this year. They released recently the BlackBerry Enterprise Server Express, which is actually really attracting for small and medium businesses. And BlackBerry for a long time be considered one of the most secure platform right now, and most of the IT department really recognize that as well. This product won many awards in terms of security in the past few years. Also, they'll be developing 15 new products this year, while in 2019 they only launched 5 products. Just quickly, I'm just showing you a few of the products that will be going out this year. One interesting one is the touchscreen bulb, which is actually a best of the two worlds, if you want. Touchscreen while having a keypad. And also the emerging markets bulb, which right now is a partnership with China Mobile, will be sold at a subsidized price, which means once you actually sign a contract, between 49 and 149, which actually positions the phone wall in emerging markets. Also, in 2009, RIM acquired Torch Mobile, which will actually bring a rich iPhone-like mobile browsing experience. So actually, to be actually able to like compete with the browsing experience you actually get with the iPhone itself. Also, a new user interface, which will help narrow the gap with the iPhone. Also, they actually got many partnership with different developers. For example, EA Games will develop a 3D game with the library. And this is one of the things that makes it lag so much behind like these application-based phones, the fact that they don't have that many applications able to compete with the iPhone. So now they will actually develop those partnership with the content providers instead of, like, for example, for the iPhone, they're not really partnering with the Apple. They're just, like, developing individually. Now they will just enter this partnership. Its email experience as well as long battery life gives them a really good competitive edge compared to the iPhone also, as well as the bandwidth advantage. It has one of the best, most efficient bandwidth in 2009, which is also really good. And also, just to give you an example, how well it actually competes with the iPhone right now, for the period from January to March, it has an increasing subscriber growth of 45% compared to the iPhone at 25. And also, it's a well-positioned entry-level phone with a significant cost advantage. So, for example, the iPhone average sells to the customer at 600, while the Google Nexus One, which is a new Google phone, so Android, is at 530. It's the RIM BlackBerry products on average are 320, and while the new RIM BlackBerry 8520 is actually even lower. So if a customer actually wants to enter a smartphone or actually buy a smartphone, it's a good price if you want. Now, obviously, largest opportunity is international. They're actually doing partnerships in emerging markets. for example, in China, which has the most growth potential, they just entered a partnership with China Mobile, which is the first number one Chinese provider. They actually negotiated with China Mobile. China Telecom, sorry, to launch also by the end of 2010. So that's really good. So they're going there. And while Bavi was not having that much of a good reputation there, they actually positioning the Bavi there. And also emerging markets and those other big telecom companies actually like the RIMs better than Apple and Google, which are always considered as dumb pipes, which means that Apple will or Google will actually use those carriers as only transferring data and sets pretty much, while RIM is actually really building partnerships with those. Slide that shows you where the revenue comes from. United States 63% and Canada 8%. There's not that much untapped market left in those countries, while other, which includes the all the emerging markets pretty much, 23%, and they want to increase it in the next coming years. So I built a DCF model. Quickly, these are my assumptions. I used the consensus cells as the forecast cells, built 2012, and then I pretty much huge assumptions after. So came up with a fair value per share of $87.38. As I told you, the consensus right now is 86, and most of the analysts actually built a DCF model because are actually getting something at 100 or so. So pretty much in the range there. Show you a few comparables. As you can see, Research in Motion trades at a lower PE than most of its competitors. Its EV/EBITDA is as well lower and has a higher return on equity there. Now, as far as the risk for the stock, obviously the macroeconomic environment could deteriorate. The competitive situation could intensify with new entrants. There could actually be delays in entering new geographic markets. New model introduction could slow. Monthly services could decline. The subsidiary growth could deteriorate. And key executives could leave the firm. And as obviously, litigation matters could pressure the stock. So my recommendation, buy at 75 or lower, which is actually trading at lower than 75 right now. And I have a target price coming from my DCF at 87.38. That's pretty much it. Thank you. Any questions? Jason?
How much cash does RIM have on their balance sheet? Do you see any potential for acquisitions anytime soon? Repeat the question.
The question is regarding the cash on their balance sheet right now and if there's possibility of an acquisition. In terms of cash, I think they have $1.5 billion. And I don't think that there's in the short, medium term any possibility of acquisition. I hope not. I mean, as being a good Canadian company, I don't know. Although it would be good for the share price, but I don't think so. And there's no really analysts actually mentioned that there's a possibility of an acquisition in the next, in the long, short, medium term. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, buying another company, right. I can't tell, no. There's nothing being mentioned that much. I mean, they've bought Torch, as I told you, like, last year for the browsing experience, browser, but, I mean, there's nothing right now to mention. Yeah, sorry. You have more questions? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Matthew, and I'm going to talk about the Corrections Corporation of America. They're the largest U.S. private prison company, and they have a market cap of about $2.4 billion. They have 46% market share of the private prison business, which I think is a very attractive industry right now. Only about 8% of all the prisons in the U.S. are owned privately, and I think that they're operating in an underserved market right now. So they're currently trading around $20, $21. As you can see, it's been outperforming the S&P for the last 5 years. They took a dip in 2008, but what I think the market really discounted too heavily is their sensitivity to the economic conditions of the U.S. I actually think that the budgetary issues in the states and at a federal level is actually beneficial for this company because it pressures the government to push towards the privatization of this business because, as you will see later, there's actually a lot of benefits, whether you look at the cost or you look at the quality of the service of these correction facilities when you're comparing private prison operators versus public. So here are a list of the investors. About 80% are institutionally owned. And if on a diluted basis, the top management owns about 5% of the shares. I think that that's good for alignment of interests. If you look at their business model, they operate about 65 correctional facilities, about 45 of which they own themselves. And for the last 5 years, they've been moving away from the contract business, which is the business that, you know, they operate the facilities, but they don't actually own. Because if you look at the EBITDA margin, they earn a much higher margin when they actually own the facilities. So right now, 90% of the EBITDA margin is from the facilities that they own, which is great. So right now, they only operate in the U.S. They have contract with all three federal agencies, 19 state agency, the District of Columbia, as well as different local agencies. And they're looking to expand mostly at the state level right now. And they don't have plans to expand across, like outside of the U.S. anytime soon. If you look at the benefits of the private prison business versus public, whether you look at the cost, the quality of the facility, and the time it takes to build a prison, the private prison business is much more efficient. So, and something I do want to mention is the crowding issue right now. Most of the states and federal-owned prisons, they actually operate over capacity, with over capacity about 117 to 130%. And this has a huge implication on rehabilitation of the prisoners, the quality, the health issues, and the safety of the guards. For example, this year there's actually a guard that was assaulted and killed by prisoners because the ratio of prisoners versus guards were way too high. So if you look at the industry, really, the revenue is driven by the inmate population growth, and for the last 100 years, it's been growing quite steadily. Something I do want to mention that there was a study that shows that upon release, on average, 31/3 of the prisoners get rearrested within 3 years. And the private prison business, I think that it's growing very, very, very steadily. And as I mentioned before, this is because the federal and the state system is operating at a high capacity level. So this is what I mean by 130%. This is a picture of the California prison. So there's a lot of advantages associated, as I said before, with private management of the prison business. For example, one of the studies showed that the mortality rate and the average escape rate is much lower for private prison operators, so that's why the market share has been increasing over the years. So if you look at the growth of the inmate population, it's been growing quite steadily, which means that they're not as susceptible to the economic conditions as people may perceive them to be. And in fact, because of historically, the inmate population growth have accelerate upon or shortly after depression. So if we do see a V-shaped recovery, it would be very beneficial for CCA, a company that's a big player in this industry. Market leadership, if you look at the competitors, they have the most beds in the inventory, which means that they're able to capture
majority of the growth of the MA population. Whether you look at the 2007 or 2008 or 2009 number, they more than 50% of the new inmates in the U.S., they are captured by the private prison business. So this has huge implication because the biggest player would be able to absorb most of these benefits. And one thing I do want to note, though, is that most of the all their other competitors, they operate operate prisons, but they don't own majority of their facilities like CCA, which has implications on the margin of their business as well. So as you can see, they've been very profitable with about 30% margin, but you see the trend lines it's quite favorable. And as I said before, unlike the competitors, they own majority of the facilities, which has implications on their higher EBITDA margin, which is why they have higher operating margin consistently versus their competitors over the years. And this is why their EPS, the EPS trend has been quite positive and stable, and same with their cash flow per share. And what's favorable from a cash flow perspective for investors is they're quite proactive with share buybacks. For example, in 2008 to up to this point, they bought back about 10 million shares. So this is always great from a cash flow perspective, the EPS per the price per share. If you look at their balance sheet, they're quite strong right now. They don't have any debt maturing anytime soon, well, at least not until 2012. And all of their debt is denominated in fixed interest, so we don't have to worry about the Fed raising rates affecting this company's financing. So if you look at the valuation or comparables, they're trading at a premium in terms of 4P in the EV/EBITDA multiple. But I think this is justified. One, because they are the largest player. They're much bigger than the other companies. Two is because the fact that they own majority of their facilities as opposed to just managing these on a contractual basis, that's they have a much higher profit margin than their competitors. For example, the Geo Group, they're one of their biggest competitors, and they only own two of their facilities, whereas CCA, they own about 45. So that's why I think that this valuation is justified. And if you look at historical forward PE of 19.9, apply the 2010 EPS consensus, you get about $25 DCF. If you keep their EBITDA margin at its current level, which I think is quite conservative, and a 38% tax rate, adjusted beta 1.16, discount rate 11%, you get about $30. If you blend this, you get a 12-month price target of $27.45. In terms of risk, there's definitely risk. Like in every business, there's always competitive pressure. To be able to gain these contracts at the state level or at a federal level, they have to go through a competitive bidding process. So as the other competitors become more aggressive, it can affect their market growth as well. And of course, this model is highly capital intensive. The average capex per bed is about 50 to 70K, and they are profitable only when they operate above 75 to 85% capacity. And a small concern is their debt maturity that may in 2012 that may affect their rating. But I don't think this is a big one. I think that they are right now sensitive to the capital markets in the sense that they are rated double B right now. If we experience, let's say, another credit crunch, for example, they may be gone from the capital market. It's going to have implications on their financing. One of the biggest concerns I have with this company is the political forces. In terms of budgetary spending, right now at the state and federal level, they're operating with overcapacity and they're having budgetary issues. But this doesn't have to translate into privatization. There's a lot of incentives, but they don't have to move towards that. If their budget improves or they decide that they want to put more priority in this. In this area, they can choose to keep most of their prisons public. And, of course, how the length of the inmate sentences will affect their business because they get revenue. The way they get revenue is it's on a per day basis and a per man basis. So the length of the inmate sentences will actually affect the revenue of this company. They get about their profit is about $8,000 per prisoner every year, and of course the legislative changes will affect them as well, because some states they actually don't allow prisons to be operated by private companies, and you know, even though they have contracts with some with many states right now, there's no guarantee that these existing states would not change their policies to like the other states where they don't allow private correctional facilities. So lastly, they always have to be careful with the public relations, because how the public views this from an ethical level or reputational level, like that can create pressure to the government in terms of how they move forward with this business. For example, there are concerns about moral issues and so forth, but. I think it's not a big risk. And if you look at everything, and in summary, I think that they're a great buy. They are a big player in a very profitable market. So my recommendation is to buy this company. So the question is, California right now, they're operating about 130% capacity. So the question was, have management responded to this opportunity? So they've always noticed this these opportunities. And in fact, in not just California, but in most states, they operate about 117 to 120% capacity. So management have like they haven't said it explicitly, but they are taking advantage of this, investing in a lot of expanding their capex in terms of increasing the number of facilities that they have across the states, and even for states that have canceled these contracts, I think Arizona canceled their contract with them. They decided to keep their keep their facilities there. In case of needs, like, for example, if there's legislative changes in California where they actually need extra prisons to move these inmates to another area, then they were able to respond to this. So yes, they have been quite proactive in doing that. So the question is, have they diversified their operations, aside from the correctional facilities business? And my answer to that is no, in the sense that they only operate correctional facilities, but they've been expanding what they do within this business. For example, they provide health and educational services to the inmates now, rehabilitation programs and things like that. So they're focusing on what they're best on, but they're improving this business line by, of course, putting a lot of emphasis on growth, and second of that, improving the quality of service by adding the features of their service. Yep. Sorry, can you repeat that question?
What's their selling point to the government? Is it only that there's so much capacity that we have extra space to take it on? The government actually, politically, they want to care about their prisoners, but if I'm trying to save money, I really don't care if I'm prisoners. I'm 130. I want my guards to be safe.
Right. So the question is, what other incentives does the government have to privatize this business? Aside from the cost, is that your question? Aside from capacity issues. So, I turned to this slide because as I mentioned before, except for the crowding issues, there's a lot of cost implications as well. So at the federal level, it costs about $100,000 to $150,000 per bed. Whereas for private prison business operators, it ranges from 50 to 70K. And a very important point is the time it takes to build a prison. So when they are operating above capacity, let's say they do want to respond to this by building their own private prison, it takes them 5 to 8 years. Whereas for a private prison operator, it takes about 1.5 years. So there is a lot of things there. And as I mentioned before, there's a lot of safety implications as well. So, yes?
When you're factoring in the lead time for prison bills at the state and federal level, does that also include the time to legislate all the pre-building stuff, whereas obviously in the private, they're just getting the order for sale. The numbers are very different. I understand the government's decisions, but it's part of it, the legislative time to
So the question is, there seems to be a big gap between the lead time of the private business and the public, and does that take into account this legislative, the legislative approval and everything? My answer to that is yes. That's actually one of the big factors, but I think the private number it doesn't include the bidding process. It's only the physical building of the private prisons. So yes, so that does affect the gap there. Yes. So the question is, how did the private business is able to operate at a much lower cost than the public? And my answer is that is because it's a bidding process. In order for the private businesses to gain these contracts at both the state and the federal level, they're required to submit a bid and with all the costs associated and et cetera. Whereas for the public, they don't really have to go through this process. They just go through it directly. So the private business have much more incentive to find all the routes to reduce their costs and their bidding price. So that's why they're able to do that. Yeah. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Amir Asef. Today I want to speak about MSCI World Index, our benchmark, and its return and risk characteristics. We will briefly review the index description, then we will move on to its return characteristics. Mainly, we will look at the investment style, if any investment style is more suitable for our purpose to track the index. we will look at the countries and to see if any country has more impact on the index, and finally on the industries to find out the optimal weights that minimize our tracking error. And we will review the risk and the relationship between the volatility of the index and volatility indices. The MSCI World Index is a free float adjusted market capitalization weighted index that is designed to measure the equity market performance of developed markets. There are 2 points in this description that I want to mention. One is it's a market cap weighted index, and the other one is cover the developed market. So we don't have exposure, the index don't have exposure to China, India, Brazil, or any other emerging market. The first question that I try to answer is that, do we have to pursue any investment style? Specifically, I'm looking to small cap value, small cap growth, large cap value, and large cap growth styles. I've used the Russell indices as a proxy to this investment style. And you can see here the loadings and correlations are reported. The large cap oriented styles show higher correlation with the index. If we want to expand our analysis and look at the value oriented styles, mainly small cap value and large cap value, we can see that the large cap value can explain their returns of the index better. The result for the growth-oriented style is the same. If we compare the small cap strategies like small cap value and small cap growth, it shows that the small cap growth has a higher R-square factor. It seems that the large cap-oriented styles can do a better job, but as I mentioned earlier, the index is a market cap weighted, so the index is tilted to large cap companies, and large cap companies have a higher impact on the index, so it's just a statistical kind of error, and we cannot conclude that we have to focus on the large cap companies. The other question is the impact of the countries on the index. I use the 23 countries that are covered by the index and calculate the R-square and the slope of the regression between the markets of these countries and our index. And the result shows that the United States has a high impact on the index. As you can see, the R-square is about 0.9. That means that 90% of the changes in the index can be explained by the changes in the U.S. market. Our focus on the U.S. market is justifiable. The other point that I want to mention is that, as you can see, the slopes are all lower than one. It means that these markets are riskier than our index, and if we want to reduce our risk, we have to diversify. But diversification in which country? In the right-hand side table, I summarize the correlation between the U.S. market and all these 22 country, and you can see the Canada correlation with the U.S. market is about 82%. So if we want to diversify, Canada is not the best choice, and we have to look to other choices as well. The other point is that the weights of industry that can minimize our tracking error. Before I present the result, I want to mention 3 points. The first, that these results are based on the historical data. These are the general guideline, and the strategist's view is the most important factor in setting the weights. So just I want to ask you to look at these results as a guideline, not the final answer. So what I've done here is that I use the iShares ETFs, 8 industries, which are covered by our analysts, and I make a portfolio using these ETFs, and the weights are set in a way that minimize our tracking error. I use the last 5 years data and last 3 months to compare. In the long run, in the 5 years data, as you can see, the industrials, to minimize our tracking error, we have to invest around 40% of the fund in the industrials and healthcare and consumers and energy about 24, 21, and 7%, respectively. In the last 3 months, industrial, as you can see, it has a higher portion of should have a higher portion of our index, and healthcare as well. If we expand the analysis and divide the last 5 years into 3 months period to see what is the highest and lowest portion of the industries which can reduce the tracking error, as you can see, industrials here, healthcare, and consumers, they have always the higher portion, and I think we can use these numbers as a guideline that to invest in different industries. About the risk, I calculate the correlation between the volatility of the MSCI index and volatility indices, and the result shows that the index has a high correlation with both of the indices, with VIX, which is the CBOE 500, S&P 500 index, and VXN, which is the volatility of the NASDAQ 100, and high R-square. So for the hedging purposes, if we can find suitable product, if we can find a suitable ETF that track these indices, or if we want to buy futures on them, both indices are a viable instrument. And that's it. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions. VXX, and no, as I, the ETF is VXS. No, because as I understand, we don't have any other choice. We have to or buy the future or the ETF. Is there any ETF? As I understand, there's no other. These are the indices. These are not the ETFs. And as far as I know, I couldn't find an ETF on the NASDAQ index. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.